Welcome on to a Wednesday edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. I am joined by the exact right person that I needed to be joined by today, given this existential crisis in the Warriors season. Welcome, ESPN's Ethan Sherwood-Strauss.
Oh, man, don't overhype me. I'm going to crumble like the Warriors are crumbling right now.
Well, I think that you're perfect for this because I think you, despite the fact that we're both incredibly rational people who would never be worried about this kind of stuff, you maybe do have your pulse sort of on the, I guess, the emotional feeling of this team, for lack of a better term, and kind of where all this their struggles fit in the context of their season. So I think this is a perfect time to get to you. I mean, so first off, in kind of a greater sense, this has been an unbelievable team all year, right?
Yeah.
Now they are struggling somewhat inexplicably. How do you think these guys feel right now, knowing they had this dream season, but it could all be slipping away right now?
Not great, Bob, I think is the response to that. And they have the weight of expectations. The other team does not, for the most part. And I wrote about it in my game or afterwards that I was in the locker room after they went down 1-2 to Memphis. And I was shocked, and I wrote about this, and I tweeted about this, at how calm and assured everybody was, how they knew this is mostly a matter of missing shots that would go down eventually. And they were so confident that I thought maybe they were even in denial, but lo and behold, that series completely shifted. That was not the case last night. For lack of a better word, they seemed rattled. They seemed defensive with the media questions. They were snapping at media members, or at least Draymond Green was, when he was asked a fairly benign question about whether or not the players pump each other up. And there might be something to this. There might be something to experience. There might be something to the idea that the lights get bright and it can be a bit of a struggle, especially for some of these guys where they're up for a big contract. Draymond is seemingly in that James Harden role in Harden's NBA Finals, where it's a big stage, a lot of money perhaps at stake, and it's not going well.
No, I guess it really isn't. And with Draymond specifically, I mean, what is wrong with him? Like, why is he not just shooting those threes that he basically took all year? Is it a health issue? Is it something in his head? I mean, have you asked him about that? What do you think the story is?
I did ask him about it. He said something to the effect of, I guess I'm not shooting it with confidence, huh? And I said, well, you know, I didn't want to say. And he said, it's okay, you can say it. It's a matter of some mystery as to whether some of what's happening is what the team asked for him versus what he's doing. I don't believe the team asked him to take that early three-point shot based on the people I've talked to. They want to, they want perhaps for him to penetrate and to find somebody else to take it. The problem is that he's penetrating and jumping right into the Yeti that is Timothy Mozgov, and that's not working out at all. So it could be a combination of a few factors where he's in a slump, his back is bothering him, he's been asked to drive, but he's also just not playing smart at all. He's playing very bad basketball.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, and to me, maybe there's a difference between this and the Memphis series. I mean, number one, James is on the other side, of course. And I think in the Memphis series, there was a feeling that they could turn up their defense even more than they had been, and that Memphis just wouldn't be able to score well enough to beat this team, even if they could get a slight modicum of offensive production. I don't feel that that's the case now, because the other team has James, and while he hasn't been incredibly efficient, there is really a floor for how bad their offense can be when he's on the other side.
That's true, and he's also somebody where, hey, I don't think it's great when you're trailing, as the Warriors have so often been, and it's near the end of the game, to go against a guy who can excel at isolation offense. I think Harden's the same way, where, again, there's a floor. He can drown out the clock, and he can still get a reasonable shot up there, and that's difficult. So here's a solution. Don't fall behind so much. That's easier said than done. But the Warriors need to get a better first quarter out of this series, and I believe that means starting Andre Iguodala. The rationale that you can't bring Harrison Barnes off the bench because that'll kill his confidence, well, he was starting last game and he scored 0 points. How much worse can it really get?
Yeah, yeah. And Rob and I hit on that briefly yesterday. It's good to hear you say that too. Or at the very least, I think that they could bring Barnes in quickly then if you're starting Iguodala and try to go to the small lineup. That's not something that they did at all, really, with Green at center. Any idea why that was in Game 3?
Probably because Green isn't quite the force that he has been around the rim, and rebounding-wise, they haven't exactly been doing a good job. Maybe that's why. There's another adjustment, and I think it was suggested, at least to me in private, by Amin Alhassan that I like, which is having, at the outset, same starting lineup, have Draymond Green guard LeBron James, so now you're giving him a new job. You're not demoting him. You're just resetting his responsibilities, and you're doing the same with Harrison Barnes, where you're just giving him a new job, which is just box the hell out of Tristan Thompson. I like that adjustment. I don't know if they're going to go with it, but that is something that I perhaps would look into.
That's a tough one. I did think before the series started that Draymond would be the best individual option on James. He hasn't really guarded him enough to say whether that's true or not, but I think Iguodala has been fantastic. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. He perhaps could stand to force LeBron left a little bit more, but that seems like a minor quibble because overall he's just been so much better than everybody else in LeBron James. And this is a situation, I believe, where the longer the series goes, well, that sounds stupid because, of course, the longer the series goes, the more it benefits the Warriors because the Cavs could win in five. But you know what I mean, where the Cavs need to win this one quick because LeBron is probably going to tire out the longer this goes. And I believe right now the Warriors need to cash in on some of the wear and tear that they've gotten on LeBron, and that means trying to trap him full court a bit, trying to speed him up a bit, just increasing the pressure now that they've had him playing these ungodly minutes. Don't let him rest on offense. Don't let him dribble unperturbed towards the end of the shot clock.
Yeah, that is a surprise to me that we haven't seen more full court pressure. I mean, maybe the concern there is that if you try to pressure him full court, he will just has such speed in a straight line that he can just blow by whoever it is. But I think that might be something I'd like to see them try, or maybe even just, you know, say we're going to send a little bit of a half-court trap at him and say, you know, throw it to Dellavedova, do something along the lines of what the Cavs are doing with Curry, I think, also just kind of keep it out of LeBron's hands until late in the clock so where he doesn't have time to back down the way that he has been, you know, and those are all kind of small strategic things. Let me ask you this, going back to Green, how did he look just from a pure physical standpoint to you out there? You were at the game in person last night.
At the outset, he didn't look to be moving well, but then he hasn't been screening especially well, which makes you think he might be hurt, but then he got a football screen on Shumpert, so maybe that's not the case. I think that he's been a little bit stiff, and he just hasn't been that much of a force. I also think that it's probably ancillary. It's probably just one of many factors that include being up for a contract, that include this particular stage, and include just not playing that well. And it can really snowball, and it can really feel like the abyss. So I just don't believe, even though it's been said that he has back spasms, he's more or less had that kind of back, and he's been using the heating pad throughout the playoffs. So I don't think it's the reason for his poor performance in these finals. I think it's one of a few reasons.
Yeah, and I do think, talking about the small lineup, I thought he was unbelievable defensively as the center in that small lineup in Game 2. I mean, some of those blocks and contested rim that he had on James were fantastic. And so, I mean, the only reason I could think of that they wouldn't go back to that, especially with how Mozgov has dominated at the rim and how they were able to get Blatt to take Mozgov out with that small lineup, would be that they just feel like he's not quite up to it health-wise. And to me, I agree with you. I thought that he did look kind of stiff. I mean, he was just, you know, I think when you have a back injury, you are more conscious about kind of not bending your back and bowing it forward. You kind of keep your lower back tight at all times. And he sort of looked to be moving in that way to me. But, you know, would I have even noticed that if Doris Burke hadn't said anything at the outset of the telecast? You know, hard to say.
Yeah, yeah. You know, maybe that's just confirmation bias at that point. And maybe, to be fair, maybe he wants that out there. because there's a lot of money at stake for him. And it looks a lot better, perhaps, if his performance in these finals is a matter of the bad back versus just really coming up short. So it's difficult to – it's really difficult to know. I feel a little badly for Steph Curry because there's so much criticism right now that's framed as, when are we going to start criticizing Steph Curry? And it's this weird dynamic where the justification is almost we treat LeBron so unfairly that we now should treat Steph Curry unfairly, which just seems like some odd logic to me. Maybe we should just treat everybody with a modicum of fairness. But in a lot of these instances...
No, that's ridiculous.
That's crazy, yeah. No, we just need to throw everybody into the stocks. Off with his head! He's a fraud! What kind of MVP is he?
Yeah, I think maybe that's why like people love Game of Thrones so much, with like all the characters dying off, is just because these guys just... It seems so arbitrary, like... who survives, and, you know, it's just a total results-based, you know, business. And so that's what people like with their sports characters, too. Like, they want to just, like, assail these people with, like, no rhyme or reason. Definitely. There's no space for nuance or anything like that.
And Curry definitely has some Stark-esque qualities. He's very trusting. He's very nice, perhaps a bit naive. And he's certainly trusting his teammates, and that trust is not getting rewarded, where I don't think he had a great first half, but in a lot of instances, they're putting two on the ball. He moves it to a wide-open guy, often Draymond Green, who's in a four-on-three situation, and they're either not shooting or missing the shot, and what do you want from Curry in that circumstance? You know, you just...
It's not even a four-on-three situation. It's a three-on-two situation or a two-on-one situation,
yeah.
Because they are just not leaving Thompson ever.
No, you're right. He's the other guy. He's the other guy who... they're focusing on, where it's just these two guys, we're guarding these two guys, the other people, you know, Andre Iguodala had a lot of room, he played well, but they're giving him a lot of room to make shots. And again, it's a matter of what do you want Curry to do. I suppose one thing that you could have him do, and we saw a little bit of it, is Dellavedova really can't guard him one-on-one. So maybe just do away with a lot of the screens. Maybe play more rock-headed. I think I heard you say in the last podcast, Mark Jackson-esque basketball, maybe you could find some success with that. Because for all the praise Dellavedova is getting, and I think that he's done a reasonably good job, especially off the ball, what he's doing is very much aided and helped by another defender, often somebody gigantic, you know, with these double teams. It's not just him. If it's just him, then that could be a problem for Cleveland.
If I'm the Warriors coaching staff, I'm looking at this, and I'm saying, seriously, we can't score with a two-on-one against Mozgov at the rim with Green and Bogut?
Yeah.
Like, are you serious? We can't score that way?
Oh, Bogut, you know, man. Like, Bogut. We're some of these times where he's even having successful plays, but they're hitting him in the hands like he just wants nothing to do with it, you know? And he's not a youngster like the other guys on this team, but this is certainly not a situation that he's been involved in before. And he's looking rattled. He's one of the players, if we're listing a few of the players who look rattled, he's certainly in that category.
Certainly. I mean, his defense, I thought, was horrendous at the start of the game on, Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. He wasn't bringing the help. There was that play where the Warriors are using that odd Curry hedge where he kind of just tags LeBron, and Bogut really should have rotated over and at least fouled or just done something instead of just letting LeBron get that dunk. But he was slow to react. He was a bit of a zombie that game. And I know the Warriors are going to change their coverage of LeBron. I'm not exactly sure how they're going to do it, but suffice it to say they're going to change it from what we saw with the weak Steph Curry hedge.
Yeah, and that you're talking about when they do Curry's man setting the screen.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You think they'll change up aside from that, or it's just going to be limited? I mean, because, you know, they're letting LeBron get 34 shots in these games, but then again, up until this last game, they really have been relatively inefficient as well.
Yes, then that's the case. And I think, I don't know if they're going to change it besides that, but I definitely know they're going to do something with that. They can't persist with it. And hey, you know, Steve Kerr's approach is definitely informed by his time as a player, where he is so worried about letting role players like himself get open three-pointers. But this might be a case where he has to go against his philosophy, because if you put two on the ball with LeBron, at least you're speeding them up. At least you're doing that. They get open shots, and they could kill you with that, and you could lose that way, but you're quickening the pace away from this grinded-out style that LeBron is playing right now.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. I mean, and I completely agree with what they were doing to start this series, and they stopped them. Like, you ultimately, you're holding them to less than a point per possession, and they got LeBron James and the other team. It's hard to really get too upset about that. I mean, I do think that their role players are going to play a little bit better at home, and we saw that in this last game. They finally got up to 9 out of 21 on threes, but I thought the key variable for the offense of the Cavs was going to be how many three-point attempts they could get up, and they've been pretty low throughout the series.
That's true, and you know, you get those role player games like Dellavedova making shots off his ass, and that's something to prepare for, and it's also... It's easy to be worried about that, and that's one of the reasons why it's so painful to lose that game too.
You think you could just come on my podcast and just swear now?
Is that like, a swear word?
You know, you're on ESPN, and now you come on my podcast, and you're gonna throw caution to the wind? That's what's happening here.
Do they say bum in Australia? Is that the term? I mean, I know they're part of that whole Commonwealth situation, that whole British Empire situation. Shots off his bum or out of his bum, whichever you want to term it. Things that can happen with role players on the road. But yes, the defense for the most part has been good. It has been successful. The problem is that the offense has been absolutely atrocious. That fourth quarter was the first 30-point fourth quarter of the series for the Warriors. That's a crazy stat.
So much has been talked about now that David Lee's going to have this big role, that maybe they found something with him. Do you buy that? Do you think that going with him is going to be some sort of a panacea?
I'm worried about it. I don't know.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm worried about it. I like the logic of playing with Andre Iguodala because Iguodala at least is so great at guarding LeBron and getting around screens that you can survive the rim protection that comes with having Lee. So I can see that as a lineup. But this idea that he's just going to come in and save the day goes against a lot of what we've seen this season, and now they're actually game planning for him. Maybe – just maybe the way he's playing can be instructive to Draymond Green about how he should be playing and how he should handle those short roles, because he did do a good job at that in the season. He's just doing a horrible job right now, and I know a lot of people think that Draymond isn't playable anymore. I certainly get the logic, and they can be right about that, but the more enticing option to me is getting Green to fix his game as opposed to getting David Lee in the situation to be the knight who saves the day.
Yeah, and I think Lee, I don't know what type of shape he's in either. You know, I mean, I think if he's playing more than 20 minutes, I'm not sure the defense can hold up.
Well, he's going to foul out before that, so it's okay.
Certainly, he should be in there with for every minute that LeBron is not in, you probably want to go with him, I think. I don't think you can play he and Barbosa at the same time. They had some success with that, but I think that was kind of more luck than process. And, you know, I do like what he's done, but it, you know, as the center, which I think is really what he's going to be playing more than taking Green's minutes at power forward, I think he's going to be in there more at the expense of Azili and Bogut.
The series is so Knicks. I tweeted that, but it's so Knicks. David Lee at center, slipping screens. It's just like back in the day with those no defense Knicks.
Yeah, and it is, I mean, Lee can at least, like, make a shot at the rim. It's his one thing that I think he's better at than Draymond is with his, ability to use both hands. And, you know, he actually has a prayer of finishing over someone like Mozgov. To me, I mean, Mozgov is very, in some ways, more effective against really athletic guys because he relies on jumping, getting his chest onto you, kind of knocking you off balance. He's not as effective kind of moving laterally, and Lee is someone who can kind of take his time, shoot from different angles, moving not directly towards the basket, and I think that that could be more effective potentially finishing inside on Mozgov than some of the other guys have done. But if Mozgov is guarding him, that's the other thing. You're now getting Mozgov away from the hoop.
Yeah, and that's got to be key for them. And that's why it's so nice to have that 1-5 pick and roll. Just get him out in space. He's not going to be as effective containing Curry as, say, Tristan Thompson. But, man, this is amazing right now. Can we just stand back from this conversation, just acknowledge what an incredible series this has been? It certainly went against my expectations. I'll certainly get made fun of by a lot of people and be, you know, a little bit blamed for Warriors' collapse. But if I can set that emotion aside, it's just been incredible and unexpected. And I'm not even sure what lesson we're supposed to take from this, because just in a general theme of it, we've covered the Warriors for a lot of the season, and they're so fun, and they get along, and they believe in strength in numbers and being this team, and the coach and the players are copacetic. They're losing to Rockhead Basketball from a team with all these recriminations and fissures between the owner, the player, and the coach. That's astounding, and I'm not even sure what lesson to take from it.
Yeah, you know, you said in your wrap-up piece last night on ESPN that, you know, nobody even returns the attempted hugs of David Blatt, except, of course, model player Matthew Dellavedova, coach's pet Matthew Dellavedova.
Guy who Blatt says is the most Cleveland guy from Australia ever. I'm not sure what's meant by that. I feel like there's some coding in there. But, yes, the players and Blatt, by all accounts, and people would argue with you on this and say, fans are weird about this. When media people talk, when there's a lot of smoke, there's fire. You know, there's not much of a relationship between the players and David Blatt. At the same time, it might be a testament to David Blatt that he's doing an incredible job and the team's performing above expectations despite that. But they're not as one. Defensively, they've been great. That trade that David Griffin made was just salvation. And they're beating a team that for so much of the season had everything running and everything humming.
Yeah, I was hopeful, just as someone who enjoys the aesthetics of basketball, that this Cleveland eyesore would finally get its comeuppance. And that is not to diminish what they're doing at all. And, I mean, they're proceeding in the most rational way to win games, and I never begrudge anyone that. On the other hand, you know, I kind of, just in my life, have tended to like to see teams win who I think advance the game of basketball and embody the teamwork that the sport is all about. Certainly the Cavs exhibit that defensively. But, yeah, I mean, we have this superstar-driven NBA culture, which really started in the 80s and then into the 90s with Jordan, about one guy willing the team to victory. And I never bought into that as much. And, you know, now I was hopeful that this would be another data point after the Spurs last year that, you know, that sort of style doesn't work as well. But, you know, maybe not.
I still don't completely buy into it, because I always do this with defense and offense. If the Cavs were the offensive equivalent of what they are defensively, we'd say LeBron has tons of help. You know, it's just that they don't have a lot of offensive talent. But then here's the irony of the series, as I've stated. The Cavs are guarding the Warriors, this reputed to be stacked Warriors team, this incredible team. We can't vote Curry for MVP because his teammates are so amazing. They're guarding him as though his help stinks. And the Warriors are guarding LeBron as though his help can kill him. That, to me, is interesting, especially in the context of a lot of the criticism of, look how many points LeBron has scored and how great he's doing versus what Steph Curry is doing.
Yeah, and I said this in one of the earlier pods, I can't remember which, that, you know, it's not this last game the Cavs were better offensively, but in the first two games, with LeBron doing what he was doing, like, they weren't scoring.
Yeah.
You know, and granted, he gets a lot of the credit because he's getting a lot of the percentage and doing all the iso ball and slowing the pace has value, to be sure. But, yeah, I mean, it's just the defense is what needs to be getting all the credit here. And I think a lot of people didn't realize throughout the year that maybe there isn't that much help offensively for this Warriors team without when Curry is really being completely taken away. And that other teams guarding this Warriors team, like, there was more help than there actually was, may have been kind of productive. On the other hand, maybe Harrison Barnes and Draymond Green will shoot threes the way they did during the regular season.
Yeah.
They're wide open, and we're not having this conversation.
Exactly. Like, Draymond Green is shooting, on the season, shot 40% on wide open threes. On a wide open three, he's essentially Ray Allen, if it's wide open. Not so much this postseason, definitely not so of these finals. So a lot of what's happening is just that these guys aren't playing up to what they've done during the season. And while I think Kerr should make a few more adjustments, and I can criticize some of the things that he's done, I'm not sure how to blame him for Green and for Barnes and for Bogut not doing things they've done all year.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and you can conduct your strategy based on what you think your players can do, and it's certainly rational to think that those guys could come through. I do think that a little bit of the criticism of Green's operation on the pick and roll versus Lee is an artificial comparison, because you remember that Lee is playing the five.
Yeah.
And so when Lee catches the ball,
you can flip that screen, and it's just, yeah.
Yeah. When Lee catches the ball, the center is basically behind him, because when Lee's playing center, he's setting the screen for Curry. The center pops out, and Lee catches the ball. The center is behind him. Now he can attack much more easily against probably some wings, especially against that bench unit he was going against.
And Lee likes playing that way now because he can't do the pick and pop from the four, from that screen and roll. You know, that was the transition ultimately that he tried to make with the Warriors, where the Knicks would use him as that 1-5 pick and roll screen slipper guy, and then when he came to the Warriors, he had to play power forward, and he had to do the pick and pop, and he developed a bit of a mid-range shot, but then it went away, and since you don't want to play him at center because it kills you defensively, that really diminished his role. So you're right, and that's a great distinction and a great point. Maybe the solution for Green is to play him at center.
Yeah, no, and they have been successful that way. So, you know, maybe they just feel like he can't physically handle it, but I still would be getting minutes for that small lineup with Green at center early on in the first and third, and then you could maybe come in with Lee for Green to anchor the bench units and try to continue the offense parade that way. And the other thing, too, I think is they can do more trying to get Klay Thompson the ball in some good spots. He's being taken out of it right now. Do you agree? They're just not letting him catch the ball, and so whenever he touches it, he feels like he has to shoot it.
Yeah, yeah. And he made a couple of those shots just off no rhythm. He's also doing this thing that a few of the players are doing where he had a good opportunity against Dellavedova, and then he hesitated, and then he got up a terrible shot, where it seems like they might be overthinking things a bit. I'm trying to remember how they've been using Klay, where they've been going to a wide pin down. They were doing a lot of pin down stuff in the first two games. Maybe they need to go back to more of that to get him involved, perhaps.
Well, so can you explain for people who don't understand exactly what a pin down is?
Man, let me think about it. I have such a bad... I'm so... It's a curl. It's basically a curl. Is that a good way to describe it? Or
it's a play where the small starts pretty much under the basket or close to the basket.
Yeah.
The big man is further away from the basket, and the big man then pins down, essentially, moves towards the basket and sets the screen to bring a shooter like Thompson or Curry away from the basket.
Yes, that's a good way. You would be a much better coach and a much better teacher of basketball than I would be. But maybe that's the way to get him involved. I liked your idea, though. You relayed an interesting idea to me, which would be they always use Sean Livingston inside pick and roll, often with somebody like Spates who can pick and pop. Maybe it would be good to have Livingston at the top of the key in pick and roll and maybe going double high and just surrounding him with shooters. And that intrigues me as an idea where perhaps he could really penetrate and get into the paint a bit, and then he's surrounded by all these shooters. Now, they probably wouldn't do it because that's not his role this season, and I know there's this fear that teams will just go under on him. But I like that idea a lot, Nate. I really do.
Yeah, and the double high kind of prevents you from really going under that easily. And, you know, that would kind of allow Livingston to turn the corner. But, yeah, I mean, again, still, though, you're going to need one of those guys to be able to shoot the ball. You know, maybe it can be Barnes when he's playing at the four. But, you know, I think the other thing too, you know, I mentioned the Mark Jackson thing. Is it possible that just in this series, if Mark Jackson were the coach offensively, they would be scoring better than they have?
Very possible. Very possible. Now, it wouldn't necessarily fix their issues with how Curry has been guarded in pick and roll. But if Mark, I could see Mark Jackson just saying, hey, try to score on him one-on-one. I think he was saying that when I rewatched in the announcing, essentially. He was telling Curry to do that. That might wear Curry out. There might be a cost to it. But, I would prefer Curry just dribbling down and taking a one-on-one off-the-dribble three-pointer every possession as opposed to what they've been running and what they've been getting. If there wasn't such a thing as fatigue, I would definitely opt for that offense over what they've done.
And you know, with Mark Jackson, I mean, you know, I could totally hear him saying, like, are you kidding me? Matthew Dellavedova can knock God Steph Curry one-on-one. Yeah.
Steph Curry is a knockdown shooter. Yeah, that's my limited fake Mark Jackson.
Well, you notice I stopped mine very quickly. But with Jackson, it would be 1-2 pick and roll, and now Klay Thompson, you go post up Matthew Dellavedova, which they actually had plenty of success with in game one. Yeah, I would have thought that,
yeah,
that they might try a little bit more of that. You know, it would be Harrison Barnes. You're going to post up J.R. Smith. He can't guard you either. You know, you're going to post up Iman Shumpert. Both those guys are too small for you. Like, put him in the goal.
Yeah.
I think you would have seen a lot of that, and it's not beautiful basketball. It's not, you know, high-ceiling basketball, but it's also low-floor basketball. Or, I'm sorry, high-floor basketball, as we talked about.
I don't recall Jackson doing that much with the 1-2 pick and roll, though. I remember seeing it a bit, and I like that. I like that because I think there's a distinct difference between the defensive abilities of Dellavedova versus Shumpert. Shumpert's been really underrated to me in this series, where – I was reminded in this series of how good he can be defensively, and I think that Dellavedova is getting this ocean of credit, and Shumpert's not getting enough.
Yeah, I do think with his health issues, both the groin and now the shoulder issue, that I might try and see whether you can force him to take a few more shots. He only had 2 shots in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and LeBron had basically like 40 shooting possessions when you consider the fouls.
Yeah, he got a good bailout foul, though. He got a good sort of just flail into the lane bailout foul that helped stem a run, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, so, I mean, you may try and distribute it a little bit more. I mean, Dellavedova was the only other Cav who took double-digit shots, and he took 17.
Some of which were terrible, we should say, but very exciting. And it was one of those, you just knew it wasn't the Warriors' night when he had that put back jump shot off the backboard.
He tipped it in the air from like 9 feet away and it went in. I mean, and you do think about it, like, he made some absolutely crazy shots in this game and he still shot 7 out of 17.
Yeah. He's not exactly a great offensive player. And maybe what the Warriors need to do, maybe what they need to do is just blitz LeBron and not worry about Dellavedova and give him some of those open shots that could kill you. You know I said that earlier, but he's been
awesome on those pick-and-pop threes all playoffs, though. I mean, that's the one shot. A wide-open three, I think, is the one shot that you can count on him to make. I think what they really need to do a lot more of is really try and deny LeBron the ball. I would go to fronting the post with him even more, and then maybe bring the help over on the front to prevent him from getting it and prevent the lob and say, all right, you know, and now we're also going to pressure the crap out of someone like Dellavedova or Smith or Shumpert, guys who aren't going to drive by you. So now he making that pass, the lob to LeBron is difficult, and then also, you know, finding a pass to Thompson or Mozgov, especially with Thompson and Mozgov in there. I think that just preventing LeBron from getting the ball, you know, if he gives it up, I think that they need to do a much better job of not letting him get it to begin with. And they can, because you can pressure the ball and not worry about those guys driving by you.
That's a great point, because this is not a team replete with playmakers. This is not a team of people necessarily diagnosed where the help is coming from and know how to attack it. So I like that idea as well. I like that idea as well. They certainly need to do something a little bit different from last night, even if overall over the course of the series, the main issue is their offense. what's surprising to me is why can't they do much when James Jones is helping to deny these after basket inbounds to Curry? Why is that flummoxing them so much? That's been a frustration of mine, where the Warriors haven't really been able to counter that. They haven't been able to successfully counter the Cavs just getting a touch on Curry around half court. They've let them dictate their pace a little bit, and that surprises me.
Yeah, and all of these things, there are counters to them. You know, like this picking up full court, which the impact of which I think has been a little bit overstated. You know, I don't think they've gone away from that, gone to that much, except when Jones is in the game and he only played 10 minutes. But in that situation, all right, fine. You know what? He's going to do that. Then you get him open and get the guy open. You can still inbound the ball. And then at that point, whoever if it's Green inbounding, which it usually is, you can throw the ball ahead to Green. He needs to sprint out of there, get ahead of Jones, which he can. And then someone else has to pick up Green because Jones is behind him, and now you got Curry on Jones.
That's another question: is what happened to the Draymond Green who'd go coast to coast? Where is that guy?
He's not getting any defensive rebounds. That's the problem.
That's a huge problem. Yeah, that's part of it as well. But you would want to rely on him in that situation to do one of his jailbreaks and to really push the pace. Yeah, there's so many things they could improve on.
He doesn't have to do it to score. All he has to do is go hard enough that whoever is guarding Curry or someone else has to pick him up. And once that happens, then you've got James Jones on Curry and get Curry the ball, and you're good to go for that possession. It's not sustainable. And overall, Jones is someone who they have not made an effort to attack. Again, that would be another Mark Jackson. Oh, you're gonna put James Jones in the game against me? We're going right at him.
Yeah.
You know, and either in pick and roll, you know, force a switch with him on pick and roll. You know, they're putting him in pick and roll every time, or they're gonna post him up or do whatever. He's not a good defensive player, and they've been letting him slide in the series.
To your Mark Jackson point, this series reminds me a little bit of how the Spurs would have these situations where Jamal Crawford was guarding Kawhi Leonard, and your response would be, just go at him and kill him. Just kill him with Kawhi right now. But that's just not how they operate. They share the ball. They're locked into the kind of attack that they do, and the Warriors can be similar, where sometimes a mismatch does demand that you directly attack it, but that's not what they're conditioned to do. They're conditioned to be a little more collectivist in their approach.
The other thing I think they could try, too, is make Green's life easier when he's setting that 1-4 pick and roll and there's a center in the game. Because what Bogut has been completely unimaginative in those situations.
Oh, man.
He's just been, like, hanging out kind of on the baseline in the dunker roll. But, like, what he needs to do is be in a situation where he can catch on the move, much as Mozgov does on the other side, right? Like, you don't see Mozgov just hang out right under the basket. When LeBron attacks, then Mozgov will get a running start, get the ball on the move, and Bogut is a much better finisher if he's on the move. So one thing that he could do maybe is kind of start up closer to the elbow, know it when they do that 1-4 pick and roll. Mozgov then will also have to be up there with him. He can't just camp out in the lane. And so then you've either got Mozgov having to scramble back to get in front of Green at the rim, or then as Mozgov does that, his momentum is moving one way, and then you could hit Bogut rolling into the basket as well if you're Green making the pass. If Bogut stands right down there on the block, then Mozgov just takes one step over, and he's right in front of Green, and there's no angle to get it to Bogut either.
That's a great point, and it also shows you the options that someone like Curry opens up for you. Because the reason why Bogut's guy has to go all the way up there for the screen is because of Curry. You know, it's not because of Bogut. You know, like, Curry makes Bogut's offensive game look a lot better than it actually is. I think as a more general non-strategic concern for the Warriors, I wonder if the trust is going to corrode at a certain point, that you have Bogut fumbling some of these passes because it looks like he doesn't want to catch them, that you have Green turning down wide-open three-point shots. And so I wonder if they're going to really start to doubt themselves and doubt what the right play is, because making the right play isn't resulting in baskets because these guys aren't making simple plays.
So we've talked completely about the Warriors and their adjustments nearly full through the full episode, and certainly we've been giving plenty of credit to the Cavs for how well they've been playing. I hope people feel that way. But what do you think the Cavs might do differently or could do differently on their end?
Man, I've seen so much through a
Warriors. Yeah, like they only have seven guys, right? It's kind of hard to say play some guy more than another. I mean, maybe there isn't necessarily anything. Maybe they stick with this. I mean, maybe what would their adjustment be now to David Lee getting more time?
That's just a crazy. It's even hard for me to fathom that. This is the conversation right now. Is how do the Cavs? The Cavs have been successful in the series, but how do they solve David Lee? That's an amazing point. That's an amazing point in time right now. They know he's short rolling.
Pick and roll.
Yeah.
Every time, I think, would be one.
Yeah, they know he's short rolling. I might want to make him finish as opposed to giving him options on those kickouts. You know, maybe really test that, I guess, is the adjustment.
Well, but it's gonna be over a small if that's the case if Lee is playing the five.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at the same time, I might prefer that. Yeah. I don't know if I believe in Lee's finishing ability, even though he was really good last night, as much as you do. Even if he can't finish with either hand, I just saw him botch so many this season. So maybe that, you know, it's hard to really find fault, even though they did almost cough up the game again. It's hard to find too much fault with Cleveland right now.
That's one thing. Yeah, like why do they blow these leads? Like how? What can they do better to avoid doing that?
It's interesting, huh? You know what happened?
I'm not sure, really. I mean, they're just hitting some crazy shots. At least last night, they were just hitting some crazy shots.
The Warriors? Well, yes, Curry specifically, but they were also missing some open shots too from some of the role players during that run. There was a wide open Klay Thompson angle three. There was a wide open Andre Iguodala three that I think he missed. So they were also getting better shots along with Steph Curry making completely ridiculous shots. But it seemed like the Warriors in their desperation were going small, pushing the pace. They finally got some good pace in that quarter. And as far as what the Cavs were doing, I mean, I want to say that they were going a little too much isolation and stuck in the mud, but that's their whole offensive approach. That's their strategy. You know, I remember Jeff Van Gundy said that on the broadcast, and I was thinking, well, how is that any different from the way the rest of this has gone?
Yeah, maybe you try to get Lee in pick and roll more. That might be one. And especially while LeBron is fresh, they even switched Lee onto him a couple of times. I don't think that's not going to work if LeBron is fresh. I think when he's worn down, it's a better strategy.
Yeah, and Lee had a couple of decent plays in that situation. I also don't think he gets a tremendous amount of ref respect, which is another problem. But, yeah, I think you have to attack him, and they will attack him. Yeah, they did attack him. That was essentially what they were doing, was to specifically target David Lee. So I'm not totally certain why what happened. I'm often – we're always looking for non-luck-related causation, but maybe some of it was just a run of poor luck. I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and really look at it from, as they say, a Cavs gaze, because I've been looking at so much of the situation from a Warriors gaze, especially with the unexpected struggles coming from that direction. Also, I just don't know what I'm talking about, Nate. That's the other problem. That's the main problem right now.
So I mean, you do have now an interesting dilemma for Kerr, which is how much are you going to stick with what you did during the regular season and try to do that better, and how much are you really now going to change up? I mean, it's very difficult, right? I mean, we talk about luck, we talk about small sample size, we talk about process, we talk about staying the course. Well, you know, that hasn't worked so far. And
I know they're having deliberations right now of what to do. And they're looking at every option. And I know that there have been discussions, at least, of the Amin suggestion. Not that Amin suggested it to them and they considered it because of that, but of the option of Draymond on LeBron. I know that's been discussed. I don't think it will happen. So they are looking at different options, but I got to say, Curzon fairly inflexible, and that's a legitimate criticism. And I come at this with the idea that I assume competence. I know that Steve Kerr is very smart. I believe him to be a very good coach. But I also think that, and it might be hindsight, that he's been pretty inflexible in this series, and it's time to adjust. It's desperation time now.
Well, so I know there are definitely things that we think he should adjust that he hasn't, but I think it might be giving him a little bit of short shrift to say that he hasn't adjusted. I mean, he's gone with Spates. He's gone with David Lee. You know, he's gone with Azili. He's gone with Bogut. He's gone with Green at center. He's gone with Barnes. He's on LeBron. He's gone with Iguodala. He even put Sean Livingston on LeBron.
Yeah, didn't work too well.
So I think that I might quibble with that a little bit, but on the other hand, I mean, some of the big stuff like Barnes guarding LeBron and letting him get off early in the first and third quarters, that's something you might point to. But what else would you say he needs to adjust on besides that?
Well, it's mainly lineups. I mean, it's what we discussed earlier, where I don't like the protection of Barnes' ego. I'll just come out and say it. I don't like it. I don't like it from the organizational perspective. Barnes is a favorite of Laker.
Well, but hold on. Wouldn't you say that worked all regular season?
That it pumped him up and pumped up his confidence? Yeah. I think that we saw the benefit of it over the course of the regular season. But I don't like it because it sends the message that opportunities aren't equal. And it's not necessarily a meritocracy on the team. And, you know, we drafted this guy higher, and maybe he gets along with the owner better. Now, I don't believe the Warriors are saying, hey, we need to keep Joe Lacob happy, so let's treat Harrison Barnes better. But I do think that it has a subtle influence. And for that reason, he gets more opportunity than some of the other players would. And he didn't earn that starting job. He wasn't better than Andre Iguodala. Iguodala is better than he is. And so I'm still not sure I love that. I can abide it for the regular season. I certainly can because it's had this benefit and Barnes is a bigger part of the Warriors' future. But in a situation like this where egos need to be set aside and you need to do what's necessary to win, no, I don't like just rolling Barnes out there in the starting lineup if that's good for his confidence. That's something that I object to. That's something I disagree with. I disagree with it with full knowledge that the people making those decisions have more information than I have been in situations that I haven't been in, and are fully capable, intelligent people. But if I have to second-guess something, I'm second-guessing that.
Yeah, I think that during the regular season, there are very good non-Barnes' ego basketball reasons to start him, one being Iguodala, an older guy, someone who can, you know, was preserved throughout the regular season. He looks probably more spry than just about anyone on the roster right now.
And the patron saint of their bench, the guy who really runs that bench unit.
Yeah, I think that's true too. You know, sort of setting the tone and the ethos of sacrifice, which, you know, we also saw from Lee as well. I think that Barnes also, at least in a lot of matchups, gives them better offense and more spacing than Iguodala. Having that third three-point shooter on the floor, a real good three-point shooter.
Someone who doesn't really have to sit in the invisible rocking chair that Andre Iguodala sits in when he sets up that three-point motion, you mean?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That is an underrated part of Barnes' game, is that the release comes quick. You know, he has a quick release three, and Iguodala has this weird swing-through motion that takes a while to develop.
Yeah, that's true. But I think now, just for this specific matchup, I agree with you. It should be Iguodala because Barnes isn't doing a good enough job on James, and whatever confidence you want to give him, it's not going to make him play any better on James. And whatever you think, you know, granted he was 0 for 8, you might think, oh, we're going to lose him confidence-wise, but whatever he's going to do offensively, it's hard to believe that he's going to make up the difference between what Iguodala is doing on James defensively versus him. So I completely agree with you on that. Is there anything else you think that he hasn't been flexible on? I nothing comes to mind, but maybe I'm forgetting something.
Yeah, I can't really think in terms of what he hasn't been flexible on apart from that. But that's the big thing. I mean, that's a massive decision. They keep starting out in the hole. and starting from a disadvantage. And so that's the biggest thing in terms of flexibility that I would question. I guess that's the main thing. There are probably other things if I go through my notes, but nothing comes to mind right now.
Did you see any adjustments that they did make in Game 3, whether they worked or not, you know, just kind of subtly to the offense maybe?
Well, they're doing more of those staggered screens. I like that a lot.
For the ball handler, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. They're doing a lot up high for Curry. I think there was one crazy sequence at the end where there were four guys taken out by three screens, if you remember that. That just an incredible shot by Curry in that situation. But they've been doing more of that, and I think that's good. And so that's not necessarily an adjustment from something they weren't doing earlier, but they're definitely going heavier on that.
Yeah, and I think that I did see some adjustments, too, to involve the five-man more in pick and rolls, get Mozgov away from the rim, which
yes.
theoretically then should open up dives for everyone else. I think that that's the next step now is once you get that five-man away from the rim to get other guys diving. And Leafs finally had some success with that, but they also, I think, could do some things where they could hit Bogut on the move after he said
that. And I should have said that because that was a big emphasis, was getting Mozgov away from the rim. I mean, as we noted earlier, and they did do that to a certain degree. And I think that, you know, that's some of the frustration right now with this team is that they've been doing some good things process-wise and still they're drowning. But that was an adjustment they made. That was an adjustment. Do you feel, asking you, that they've properly figured the Cavs out and that they're going to actually turn this around, or have you lost faith in this team?
No, I still think they're going to win it in seven. That was my pick before the series, and although that always amuses me when people are like, well, I picked the Knicks to win 40 games before the season, and then, like, you know, they're at the point where they would have to win, like, their last 20 games to get to 40 wins. Like, well, I picked this before the season. I'm going to stick with it. You know, I think they can get there. You know,
well,
like,
I picked Warriors in five, so I'm still rolling with that.
Yeah.
They're going to rescind. The league is going to look at that weird inadvertent whistle, and the decree is going to come down that it's actually now a tied series, or not a tied series, where the Warriors are up 2-1. And it's still possible. So I'm riding out that selection. You can't go back on your pick, Nate.
Do you think the refs have had much of an effect on this series, or maybe not an effect, but an advantage for either team?
No, not particularly. I don't think that they advantaged the Cavs. They just did in a few big moments that made it seem like they were they were pro Cavs. But I don't think that they necessarily helped the Cavs throughout the game. I thought that's a fairly solid ref crew that made a few odd decisions last game. I do think, though, that if you are a home playoff team and you see Scott Foster and Tony Brothers, you're scared. You know, I don't know if there's any truth to it. I don't know if there's any truth to them having a worse effect on home teams. But I just think that's something that a home team would worry about, just given the track record. And I frankly couldn't tell you whether or not that's fair. I'd have to, you know, when people focus on the refs with that confirmation bias, there's so much information to draw from that you would have to do an intense analysis to see how fair it is. But it's not just the foul calls made; it's the foul calls not made. So there's just so much possible influence distributed all around that I don't claim to be smart enough to just know off the top of my head whom it's benefiting.
The one thing I could maybe point to is that
Mozgov's verticality.
Well, that might be one. I've only seen one play that I thought was an issue there. And
Tristan Thompson, the way he was being officiated, where it seems like, now I'm going to sound all biased towards the Warriors, that he's allowed to foul people in pursuit of offensive rebounds, but the second he fails...
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is those loose ball fouls in Game 2. I don't remember any game in which there were that many loose ball fouls called on guys going for offensive rebounds. Now, you know, watching all of those live, they sure as heck looked like fouls to me.
Yeah.
And Bogut has a reputation of using his hands too much, and he, in fact, does use his hands too much. His technique was not very good on the defensive glass, and I think that's a big reason why he was getting called for those.
I do. I also think that it's maybe you got to give credit to Tristan Thompson, who's not a savvy veteran, but he knows how to pursue a ball with enough activity that refs respect aggression, I think, and he aggressively pursues it, and then when he's at a disadvantage, he really sells the call and he sells the flail. So he does both those things well, and that's been working out for him.
All right, well, so anything else to say? I guess I should ask you. I mean, I think it's going to be Warriors in seven. What about you? Have you lost faith in the Warriors, this season-long juggernaut?
I might have. You know, you don't want to publicly say it because then you get criticized when they come back and they swing it.
I think you just did, though.
Well, I'm just trying to be honest. You know, I could just stay with
we don't encourage that on this podcast.
Yeah. You don't have to be honest on this podcast. I don't know. I have smart people telling me that the Warriors have turned over a new leaf and that they'll correct all this. But I'm also pretty concerned about just some of the human factors and how they've responded and how diffident they seem and how coming apart of the seams they appear. So, gun to my head, and it would be very odd if somebody put a gun to my head, but it's quite possible in Cleveland, just given the passion of the fan base. But gun to my head, I would pick the Warriors to win the series, but it is not with a great degree of confidence.
Yeah, I will say this. This is a team that, while people have kind of derided them as front runners throughout the season, and they've had a lot of blowout wins, when they get down, they respond. Like, in that Memphis series they did, you know, and even in games when they're desperately trying to come back, maybe you could say they wait a little bit too long to get into that mode. But it's going to get to that point now very quickly, and there are some tough guys on this team, some proud guys. And Green is one of them. The biggest thing that gives me pause about the Warriors, if we didn't know that there was this back issue for Green, I would feel very confident about picking them.
Yeah.
But if, you know, I think we'll get a little bit more information to see how much of an issue that is for them. And, you know, if he keeps turning down shots and playing like this, I mean, that's the number one thing. He just has to play better offensively. That's if he does, they're going to win the series. If he doesn't, then, you know, they're going to be in this scratching, searching, trying to have to change up what they do, go to David Lee, ISO more, you know.
And if you remember,
normally do.
If you remember what turned around the Memphis series, what got them off to that great start when they were down 1-2, it was Draymond Green getting a couple threes, if memory serves. That's a huge swing for them. That is the panacea of all panaceas. And, man, so much is on his shoulders and so much is on Curry's shoulders.
All right, well, so that's probably enough for this series, but there was one other thing I wanted to ask you about, which was a great piece you did a couple of weeks ago that I wanted to get your take on. It might seem a little odd now, but you wrote a great piece about basically Kerr making basketball fun again, and that, you know, he kind of eschews suicides and he eschews some of the negative reinforcement and, you know, just, you know, kind of miserableness of being a basketball player with some coaches. You know, we've all felt from some certain coaches. You know, does that really set this team apart compared to some others?
Yes, compared to some others. Compared to, say, a Thibodeau team where you're getting drilled into the ground and you're getting briefed on these are the 17 actions that this team runs, and there isn't so much of the individual work and so much of a break. The Warriors are a team very much influenced by Popovich, very much influenced by the idea of work-life balance, very much influenced by the idea that basketball isn't everything, isn't life. You can read some of that in Lee Jenkins' fantastic recent profile of Kerr, and the Warriors are also mixing that with a little bit of science, where in practice they have that body tracker, that heart monitor, and they try to see whether or not these guys are getting fatigued. And if they are getting fatigued, then they might sit them for a game. And the way you determine that is essentially if your heart rate is going up, but you're going slower. And that's how they track it. So that's the scientific aspect. Plus, they try to make everything a competition. That's another way to keep people engaged and keep things fun, is to make practice competitive. And you'll see this. This was actually done right in front of the media in Oracle, where they have this odd shooting competition with rules that are a bit arcane. I don't completely understand the rules, but they have everybody around the arc with, you know, including Spates including David Lee, including Brandon Rush, and they try to be the last man standing, and that's a way that you do practice. So the idea is to make everything fun, everything high energy. That includes playing music at practice, blaring music, that continues to play until Ron Adams has to tell them what they're supposed to do defensively. So the idea behind it, it's sort of a depressing idea when you think about it, is that the NBA season is not fun, that it is a repetitive grind, that you essentially need painkillers along the way, you know, be they music, be they these, you know, little games of competition, and that will see you through. But I also think it's effective and it's dealing with the reality of the situation.
I loved hearing that they don't run suicides. And to me, I think that every moment that you're running a suicide is a waste of energy and a waste of time, because you are not, like, there are a million actual basketball things you can do to get better at basketball skills that will also get you in shape just as much as a suicide. And, you know, and you're not even spending most of your time on a basketball court just running up and down to begin with. You're going side to side, you're shooting when you're tired. You know, those are the sorts of things that can actually make you a better basketball player. I mean, I'm not saying suicides are worthless, like getting in shape is valuable, but you can get in shape in a way where thinking about something other than, oh my God, I'm so tired from running.
What a novel idea. What a novel idea that you would get in basketball shape by doing basketball things. It reminds me of Andre Agassi's biography, a very interesting biography, where he linked up with a trainer who said to him, why are you running 5 miles a day? Why are you doing that? Why are you jogging 5 miles a day? And Agassi says, well, you know, to be in shape and to have stamina. He's like, yeah, but that's not like any of the type of energy you're expending on the tennis court. You're doing these quick lunges and these brief explosions. Shouldn't you be doing that in practice as opposed to just jogging and wearing out your knees? I think it's very similar, where the best way to get in the basketball shape is by doing basketball things. And I think that doing individual work on what these guys need has the added benefit of treating them like individuals instead of treating them like drones. And I think there's a benefit to that. I know the Hawks do a lot of that, and this might not be the time to extol the virtues of the Atlanta Hawks, but I think that's been successful for them, to treat guys like individuals instead of just having everybody run around like zombies.
Yeah, you know, I thought it was ill portent for the Lakers season. I watched their real training camp on NBA TV, and they did like 15 minutes of just jogging around with their hands up at their, you know, with their elbows up and their hands up in the air. And I'm like, all right, you know what? Like, maybe that'll get you in shape a little bit. Maybe it'll teach you a little bit to keep your hands up. But like, that's 15 minutes, and, you know, who knows how many calories of energy or whatever unit you want to use to measure energy that you just wasted on something that's essentially punitive. And, you know, there's some value in learning to fight through, but maybe you can do that like while you're going through a shooting competition, or when you're in a 2-on-2 drill or something that is actual basketball. And then what's more, you learn to operate while you're actually tired and do basketball things, and learn not to have your concentration disrupted by being tired.
It seems like that just harkens back to this old puritanical idea of sports, that you need to not have fun, that you need to be miserable. So
you've got to do the hard work. Yes. You've got to do the dirty work, you know, and maybe that's true, but maybe if you just make that instinct and you make it something that you're in shape to do, and it's a natural instinct instead of something like, all right, this is going to be hard, but I really have to do it. I think that's a more effective mentality.
In general, I think spending time on the sports is better in sports. I remember reading,
explain how.
Well, I remember reading in The Blind Side, I think it was in The Blind Side by Michael Lewis, where Bill Walsh was asked about delivering fiery speeches in the locker room, really lighting into his team. And he said that, I tried it once, and then we went out there and we got killed, and I just didn't see the numbers in it. So now all I do is I just talk about the strategies that we're going to employ. And that makes a lot more sense to me. And even though there's this appeal of what sports are supposed to be and what the grizzled, hardened coach is supposed to do, maybe in a workplace, it's better to just focus on the work when it's time to work.
It's funny, right? Like, I would, when we were in high school, we were in our practice gym was in the middle of this field house at Oak Park River Forest High School, my proud alma mater that I've now mentioned two podcasts in a row. Huh. And there was a track that ran around the basketball court. And so you'd see the track guys running all the time. And so I'd always make fun of them and say, like, hey, like, our punishment is your sport, right? Like, we run as punishment, and that's your sport is just running. Like, it's so boring. But, like, why does there need to be a punishment, especially when you're a professional, you know? Like you obviously, I mean, I think the vast majority of NBA players, not all of them, are really motivated guys, and they want to get better. And so why are you going to make them do something that's so miserable? There's so much tedium, you know, and work that goes into being a great player. So why not try to make it fun, try to make it competitive, and try to,
because
most of all,
even... Because the point. Yeah. Because that appeals to people for some reason that I can't understand, and you'll see it infiltrating strategy. I think on the football level, to use another football analogy, there's this ethos and this idea of establish the run. Don't get pass happy. And I think the belief underpinning that is just that running is boring and miserable, and we can't do the thing that's seductive and fun, because then what might happen? Then what might happen if we follow that temptation? So I think there's a puritanical self-punishing strain in sports that is counterproductive often, but for whatever reason, we're attracted to sports as something that's supposed to teach us harsh lessons about life.
Well, there's a million commercials of, you know, Gatorade-colored sweat coming out of guys' pores as they run up and down stairs and, you know, sprint up sand dunes and stuff. You know, so, like, there's just this whole culture around that, and it's the idea of hard work and doing something miserable is celebrated, but I don't think that that's the way to do it.
It's very American, I would say. It's a very American way to view things, where we don't have all of August off, as some car commercial I think said, actually, that was pro-American in our workaholism, where there is this competition that we have, a competition of misery, where, oh, you work 80 hours? Well, I work 90 hours, where misery is the point, where we're almost doing a blank measuring contest of who has the more myopic, awful approach to what they're doing. But for all the great things about our country, I think that's one of the less great things that seeps into all of culture.
Ah, a great note to end on for Berkeley graduate Ethan Sherwood.
Known communist.
All right, yeah, well, so we probably should wrap this up. Thanks so much for your time. I know you're in Cleveland. You've been writing a lot. You got a lot of interview responsibilities and whatnot. It was fantastic to have you on. Tell us where we can find you on Twitter.
Find me at Sherwood Strauss. Find my articles on ESPN. And thanks so much for having me, Nate. I always feel like I learn a lot.
All right.
And by the way, it's also my first time.
All right. So for the rest of y'all, you can follow me on Twitter, Nate Duncan NBA. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. Give us a rating, which I'm sure will be extremely high given the quality of guests that we had on today. That's appreciated. Do it now before we revert back to the mean, before the show regresses. This unsustainable run of a great podcast here could be coming to an end. So rate us now. We really appreciate that, and appreciate Ethan coming on. We will talk to you all next time. Probably have Danny on at some point before the next game, since he's been in Cleveland too, but we had to do one with Ethan since he was available right now at this potential nadir or potential coming together of the Warriors season. We will find out which on Thursday. Talk to y'all then.